Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Contraceptives Mandate and Religious Freedom Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 30th, 2014, the Supreme Court issued its decision in Burwell v. Hobby Lobby Stores and Conestoga Woods Specialties v. Burwell. Both cases involve a challenge by small, closely held corporations to a regulation issued by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, often called the Contraceptives Mandate. Under the Contraceptives Mandate, companies are required to provide their employees with health insurance that covers a broad array of contraceptives, including some that may function as abortifacients. The corporations and their owners assert religious objections to this mandate, and the principal question before the court is whether the mandate violates the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993, or RFRA, which requires that the government not substantially burden a person's exercise of religion unless that burden is the least restrictive means to further a compelling governmental interest. In an opinion delivered by Justice Alito, the court held that as applied to closely held corporations, the HHS regulations imposing the contraceptive mandate violate the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Per Justice Alito, RFRA protects closely held for-profit corporations like Conestoga and Hobby Lobby, and HHS's contraceptive mandate substantially burdens the exercise of their religion. Assuming for the sake of argument that the government has a compelling interest in guaranteeing cost-free access to health care, the mandate is not the least restrictive means for the government to achieve this goal. Chief Justice Roberts, as well as Justices Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas, joined the opinion of the court. Justice Kennedy filed a concurring opinion. Justice Ginsburg filed a dissenting opinion, which Justices Sotomayor, Breyer, and Kagan joined. Justices Kagan and Breyer also filed a separate dissenting opinion. The decision of the Tenth Circuit, which ruled on Burwell versus Hobby Lobby Stores, was affirmed. The decision of the Third Circuit, which ruled on Conestoga Woods Specialties v. Burwell, was reversed and remanded. To discuss the case, we have Professor Michael P. Moreland, who is the Vice Dean and Professor of Law at the Villanova University School of Law, as well as Professor Richard Garnett, who is a Professor of Law and Concurrent Professor of Political Science and the Founding Director of the Program on Church, State, and Society at the University of Notre Dame School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Moreland.
I'll just say a few words about the background to the contraceptive mandate and then some brief remarks about this morning's decision. The Affordable Care Act, which is the health care reform bill enacted in 2010, had as one of its provisions that employer-provided plans had to cover a range of preventive services without requiring copays on the part of the employees who are covered, and then delegated to the Department of Health and Human Services deciding about what the range of preventive services would be. The department then tasked the Institute of Medicine with coming up with a list of preventive services to be covered, and accepted the IOM's recommendation that among these covered services would include a number of contraceptives and IUD devices, including some that religious free exercise claimants argue have potential abortifacient properties. When the department promulgated this regulation, they did provide a relatively narrow exemption for a range of religious institutions, basically houses of worship, and then later on accommodated some religious nonprofits, universities, hospital systems, and the like, from this requirement. But there was no exemption or accommodation for-profit businesses. And that brought us then to the threshold of today's decision in Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood, which were two claimants who were for-profit businesses run in a closely held corporate manner, who had religious objections to providing the abortifacient drugs and the IUD devices as part of the employer-provided plans. And again, they had no exemption or accommodation from this requirement from the administration. So they filed a claim. The Hobby Lobby and Oklahoma Corporation won in the 10th Circuit, and Conestoga Wood, a Pennsylvania corporation, lost in the 3rd Circuit. And those are the two cases that were consolidated and were decided today. Justice Alito wrote the majority opinion for five-justice majority, arguing that, at least as a threshold matter, that for-profit businesses do have claims that they can bring under the 1993 Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And that was the premise of the claimant's argument here, that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was a statute enacted in 1993, in response to the Supreme Court's decision in Employment Division versus Smith in 1990, requires that when the federal government imposes a substantial burden on religious free exercise, that the government show that it has a compelling interest and has pursued the least restrictive means of accomplishing that interest. And so Justice Alito, in his majority opinion for the court today, argues that indeed these for-profit business owners do have the ability to bring these free exercise claims under RFRA. That is in many ways the sort of central issue between Justice Alito's majority for the court and Justice Ginsburg's dissent over that issue. Although the sort of all-out claim that for-profit corporations have no ability to bring these free exercise claims was not something that Justice Kagan and Breyer, in a separate part of their dissent, said they were not willing to reach that issue. The real problem with the government's imposition of this mandate, according to Justice Alito's majority opinion, was that the government failed to establish that it had pursued the least restrictive means. That is, it had failed to show that the way in which it imposed this mandate on claimants such as Conestoga Wood and Hobby Lobby was the least restrictive means of accomplishing the government's interest. Whether compelling or not, the majority opinion actually sort of says, we'll just assume for the sake of argument that this is a compelling government interest. The real problem with the government's case, though, was that they had failed to show that they had narrowly tailored the way in which they imposed this mandate on for-profit businesses such as Conestoga Wood and Hobby Lobby. And the proof of that was the fact that the government had accommodated nonprofit religious institutions by giving them an opt-out from this, by requiring that their insurance carriers provide this benefit without the employer having to cover it. And as Justice Kennedy and others point out, Justice Alito also points out, the government can provide this benefit itself. And that is another less restrictive means of imposing the mandate. So I think the decision really kind of came out the way a lot of us might have expected after the oral argument, that you had a five-justice majority holding that RFRA claims can be brought by closely held corporations such as Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood, and that the real Achilles heel in the government's case here was the government's failure to establish that it had pursued the least restrictive means of accomplishing that. So that's a bit of background and a quick high-level summary of Justice Alito's majority and a little preview of some of the arguments made by Justice Ginsburg in her quite strong dissent. And with that, I will turn it over next to Rick Garnett.
Thanks, Michael. I appreciate that. Very helpful summary. I think I might try to supplement or amplify that just a little bit, not so much by focusing on the details of the lead up to the litigation, but maybe even taking things to a higher elevation if you want. So if you go back in time a little bit, like way back in time, I think it's fair to say that we've always been confronting this general question of how to deal with the fact that in a religiously diverse society like ours, that has a government like ours, that does things, that regulates, there is going to be conflict, there's going to be tension. The only way to eliminate the tension between religious commitments on the one hand and government regulation and the government's idea of the common good on the other hand is if everybody agrees, or if the government doesn't do anything. But of course, in our society, the government does a lot and there is disagreement. So the problem that RFRA addresses is one that is ineradicable. The existence of that problem should come as no surprise to us. We have a country where lots of people have different deeply held commitments, and we have a government that does a whole lot in pursuit of its understanding of the common good. So we have to think about how are we going to deal with these kinds of conflicts. And throughout our history, the Supreme Court has kind of waxed and waned and wandered in terms of how it was going to deal with those. But maybe a big watershed moment, as I think Michael suggested, was with the Employment Division versus Smith case 25 years ago or so. In that case, the Supreme Court told us that it was not the job of courts, it was not the job of unelected federal judges to second-guess the cost-benefit analysis or the balancing that legislatures do when they're deciding whether and how to accommodate religion. The court recognized, I think, that accommodating religion is important, that our commitment to religious liberty is deep, that religious minorities can be vulnerable. But I think what was driving the court's opinion in Smith was a sense that courts were not very well suited to second-guess the judgments that legislatures came to. We can argue the merits of that decision, but I think that's what it was. Well, whatever we think of the merits of that decision, it seems pretty clear that Congress thought it was wrong. And so, as you've heard, a couple years later, Congress nearly unanimously enacts the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And that's the act that's at issue in this case today. But one way to think about what RFRA did is to regard it as Congress's response to Smith, where Congress, in effect, is saying, we want the courts to second-guess our work. We want the courts to help us strike the appropriate balance between religious objections on the one hand and government policy and government compelling interests on the other hand. We want courts to make sure that we've taken due account of the burdens that even general laws can impose. One way to think about it would be Congress inviting the court into a shared project, right, of making sure that religious freedom is accommodated to the extent possible. It's not going to be possible to accommodate religious liberty claims all the time. It wouldn't be desirable to accommodate religious liberty claims all the time. But the policy of RFRA, I think, is that when religious liberty claims can be accommodated, they should be. And we haven't had a whole lot of decisions from the Supreme Court telling us how to think about RFRA, about how its terms should be applied, about how broadly or narrowly it should be construed. And for me, one takeaway of today's case, wholly and apart from the specifics having to do with the mandate and even having to do with Hobby Lobby's particular objection, is I think the majority's opinion talks about RFRA in, I think, a very broad and generous way. Right? The policy of RFRA is seen as a general one, inviting religious accommodations. The idea that RFRA should be construed narrowly as having to do only with a few subsets of cases like the kind that the court's pre-Smith precedents had dealt with, that view is rejected. Justice Alito's explicit that the test that RFRA sets up, the balancing test that RFRA tells courts to apply, is a very demanding one. But again, what's interesting about this approach is because it's happening under a statute and not under the Constitution, what we have here isn't what some people might call judicial activism or the court kind of imposing a one-size-fits-all answer to tricky questions of cost-benefit analysis and so on. This is a dialogue. Right? Congress enacted a statute. The court's applying the statute. Congress remains free to respond. And I think this is an approach to the exemptions and accommodation problem that's a healthy one. Now, how RFRA will be applied in other cases going forward remains to be seen, but I think, and again, this is wholly apart from the contraceptive mandate debate, I think the court's instructions for the future to lower courts is think about RFRA broadly, take RFRA seriously, regard its policy as being one of generous accommodations, and I think that's a healthy development.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.